Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday, October 2nd. Currently 48 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 49 degrees. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Wasatch back. Yes, certainly getting a nice stretch of late summer temperatures. It's sticking around with high pressure still in place. So temperatures, of course, in the early morning hours, nice and cool, but we warm up to the mid-70s. Quite pleasant for Park City this afternoon. And there's really not a significant change in the weather pattern heading into the weekend. We do have a bump up in southwest flow on Friday that will nudge us up to 80 degrees for highs. Otherwise, it's kind of a wash, rinse, and repeat from today to tomorrow. Overnight low still in the upper 40s. From 80, we have a front passing through far northern Utah. It's a dry front as the main system passes through the Pacific Northwest. So just grazing northern Utah, dropping us back down into the low 70s as we get into Saturday. Gorgeous weekend in store with those mid to low 70s, overnight lows in the mid 40s. So no systems really popping up in the next 7 days. Could start to see increasing cloud cover next Tuesday. Some of the long range models hinting at potentially a system that could finally bring some rain back to the state by maybe Wednesday or Thursday. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. For Heber, highs near 83 today, overnight lows in the upper 30s. Plan on those temperatures kind of hanging out in the low 80s tomorrow, and then 86 on Friday. We drop into the upper 70s on Saturday, so hovering right near 80 degrees for the weekend, and then those low 80s into next week. Really just kind of calm and pleasant conditions sticking around at least through middle of next week.
Okay, Nate, thank you. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes. He'll have an update on several of the development projects throughout the county, as well as last night's open house on the Stuyvesant Basin General Plan. Also, the founder and artistic director of Odyssey Dance Theater, Daryl Yeager, with details on the production of Thriller. It opens tonight with a run through October 13th at Park City's Historic Egyptian Theater. And finally, the executive director of Summit Community Gardens and Eats, Helen Nadelin, with a final recap of this year's gardening efforts. On the phone now with an update on some of the development projects happening in Summit County, I have Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Good morning, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so are you settling into the job?
Settling in. It seems like I'm running from meeting to meeting to meeting, and I actually thought when Pat had the job and I was sitting in the room next door, I knew exactly what he was up to, and now I've found out. So it's something of a surprise, but very exciting.
Yeah, so I guess what keeps you the busiest, just meetings? I mean, or is it just kind of managing the team of planners you've got?
A little bit of both. We've been doing some structural reorganization within the planning department, adjusting some powers and responsibilities in the department, which we're going to run through to the end of the year. That seems to be working really well. I'm always constantly amazed at the dedication and the skill set of the people I work with, always have done, and being in this role has actually just opened my eyes even further and made me realize how much I depend on them.
Great. So have you put in your budget request? Are you asking for any more help?
Millions and millions and millions. No, in all seriousness, yes, we are actually looking to adopt a new junior planner, what we'd call a planner one. If we can get another planner one for next year to help out at the lower end of the scale, then that's going to make the future transition through the department much easier. I imagine, despite my personal desire to live forever, I'm not going to be here forever, so eventually I'm going to tap out. We've got senior planners who are probably going to come to the end of their working life in you know, the next few years. So we actually looking for where is the next generation of planners going to come from. I actually want to live in a town that can be designed by one of my current junior planners. That's what I'm looking forward to, and we're trying to train those people into those skill sets.
Wonderful. Well, let's start with an update on the general plan, because that's going to kind of show us the way. You're under that general plan updating process for both the Stuyvesant Basin and the East Side areas. An open house was held last night, I believe, for the Stuyvesant Basin general plan update. Any highlights from that?
I'm always constantly fascinated that people are willing to turn up for something that I thought was only of interest to planners, but clearly it's of interest to everybody. We spend a lot of our time frustrated when someone turns up at the very end of a process and says this the first we've heard about it. So what we've been trying to consciously do is reach out to people at the very beginning of the process, explain to people the visioning that we did last year, throughout the whole of last year. Countywide visioning is exactly that. This is just the dream set, the long-term goals. The general plan is essentially the roadmap and how we're actually going to try and achieve some of those visions, the policies they're going to be put in place, what, you know, what is right, what is wrong, what needs to be tweaked about the existing general plan. And then eventually, a year from now, so that will actually lead to changes in the development code, the rules and regulations that we put into place that, you know, will actually dictate what people can or cannot do on their property. And that's usually the most important part of people's lives, but the general plan update is where they can influence those decisions now. Last night, we probably had two or three dozen people, all very engaged, all very interested. A lot of people asking questions. I was actually, you know, quite excited. We had a little highlight breakout room where we were discussing in particular housing, housing density types, differential sets, what form housing should take, whether it should change from what we have today, whether it should not. That's obviously a currently hot topic. So we had people rotating through that room, getting a little mini slideshow all of their own, presented by our very own Madeline Madonna. So that was my highlight of the day.
Mm-hmm. Well, how many changes do you expect to be made to the general plan? I mean, this happens like every 10 years, yeah?
It's in theory, we're supposed to do some significant rollout every 5 years. We actually require to actually review it, and we discuss it annually. And there are tweaks and changes. If you remember, over the last couple of years, the state actually mandated a section of the general plan that all jurisdictions have to put into place, and that's what they call the moderate income housing plan element of the general plan. So that was actually added in more detail a couple of years ago. It was it has to be revised and renewed pretty much every year. So that's actually a fairly significant impact to the general plan every year. But we've not, apart from that, we've not made any significant changes probably in 10 years. About 5 years ago, 7 years ago maybe, we actually did the Kimball Junction Neighborhood Plan, which was a very detailed update to one particular area of the Snyderville Basin. And we imagine that if you imagine that whole process that we did for the Kimball Junction Plan now being applied countywide, separately on both the east and west side. So this is actually a deep dive. It's going to take us probably through to the end of next year to complete. It's something we can't afford to do every year, otherwise we'd be doing nothing but the general plan update. But it is the most significant piece of work we've done in a long time.
Yeah, so it takes that long just to make the amendments to the general plan or to institute the development code changes that then reflect the general plan?
The development code, there's probably going to be some development code changes that will run in concurrently with the general plan update, but the general plan itself is going to take a year. I don't imagine that coming out of the Snyderville Basin plan, there's going to be significant policy changes. There may be some tweaks. I think what we learned through the visioning session, that fundamental values of the community have not changed. The question is whether the policies we have currently in place are actually achieving the vision that we want. And if we need to make some adjustments to those, where are they going to come? What are we going to put in place? How are we going to deal with transportation impacts, housing impacts, economic development? How are we going to continue to protect the open space? Are we moving in the right direction? Are we happy with the results, or do we need to change anything? The visioning was a really good exercise. It was countywide. It made us realize that no critical points other than those general ones. How are we going to drill down and solve the housing affordability, the transportation issues, those ones that crop up on a regular basis? The time it takes generally is to make sure we properly engage with the public. This cannot be a top-down implemented strategy. It has to come from the significant amount of engagement that we do with the public, hence the open house, hence the continuing engagement that we will be doing throughout the year. First round, create a draft plan, second round, a revised plan, and then finally adoption. Long and complex, but very worthwhile.
So you mentioned that moderate income housing plan that had to be part of a general plan. My guess is that that is relative, depending on where you live? I mean, what is a moderate income house in some in the Snyderville Basin?
I we're going to be having a long and complex discussion about this on Thursday. Our county council have a retreat on Thursday all day and Friday all day. Thursday morning, Jeff Jones, our economic director and housing director, will be actually doing a detailed presentation of housing. I'll be sitting at his right hand, helping where I can in that. And I'm going to be doing my update in the afternoon on the community development department, the building statistics, the planning projects we have in place. But the housing element has obviously become, you know, it's a hot topic nationwide, if not worldwide, specifically in Utah and in Summit County. As you correctly identify, we have a significant difference in income between Summit County and other parts of Utah, and we have different income levels between the east and the west side. Those have direct impacts on the cost and affordability of housing. The state actually describes the moderate income housing, what we commonly know as the affordable housing, as 80% of the area median income, what you can afford with that 80% area median income. And if you use Summit County's median income, that's an extraordinarily high number. It means that most people, including none of my planning staff, could actually afford to buy a house, a market rate house, using their salary. So why do we have this disparity? What can we do about it? Do we want to do something about it? Should we be doing something about it? What are the advantages and disadvantages in having these extraordinary income disparities and the cost and affordability of housing? It's a complex question. Jeff's going to be digging into a great detail on Thursday. I believe it's a county council meeting. It should be a public meeting. It should be available on Zoom, if not in person.
Okay. And before we move off, how would a general plan dictate what would happen with a project like Dakota Pacific?
Dakota Pacific, it has its own little complication. Obviously, it's an inheritance of an existing development agreement for those people who've been in a coma for the last 5 years. That's the old Park City Tech Center site that was previously approved, and we're going to use a number without discussing the reasons why, of 1.3 million square feet of commercial development, which was supposed to be high-tech office research facility based in Kimball Junction. As those of you have been awake and paying attention, with the development of the Kimball Junction Neighborhood Master Plan, which called for a revision of some of the existing development agreements and perhaps the introduction of more mixed-use residential commercial developments in that area, can we take a more holistic approach to land development? The Dakota Pacific Group came in with a plan a number of years ago, which received a warm reception in terms of it was hot by the planning in terms of what they were proposing, and I think they were in the 1,100 residential unit kind of range. Now what we're doing is trying to like scale that back, mix it up, add in some public amenity spaces. There's been ongoing conversations with council for the last 2 years about the details and complexity of their development. Those meetings have now gone into the public session every Wednesday for the foreseeable future. The council and Dakota Pacific will be discussing in work sessions during the open meeting proposals and how that's going to develop and how it's going to change. The general plan will actually be used as the vision document. The Kimball Junction Neighborhood Master Plan does call for places for people. It calls for seamlessly connected neighborhoods. It calls for a pedestrian-oriented environment, but it also calls for a potential increase in livability and mix of uses. So the general plan is a guiding document, but this one is very much beyond the general plan level of view. It's into a much more detailed actual proposals appearing on paper in front of the public so that we can start discussing what those proposals might do and what those impacts are going to cause.
Okay. So the temporary zoning ordinance that was implemented in January expired the end of July. What's changed here?
Oh, are you speaking of the subdivision ordinance?
Yes, exactly.
Yes. The state actually mandated that all the jurisdictions essentially simplify the subdivision ordinance. It what it actually does at the end of the day, it removes the county council as the final decision-making power on some subdivision ordinance and plat amendment proposals. It's the reason that a subdivision, if someone brings in a, we'll call it a simple subdivision, a number of units that meets current zoning, that meets current code, it's actually an administrative approval, and it should be a very simple process. Sometimes they get more nuanced and more complicated. The state decided that they want everyone to take a step back and say, no, where it's simple, it should be a short-term process. The temporary zoning ordinance we put into place was essentially our version, the Summit County tweak to that ordinance, meet state code. Let's run with that temporary zoning ordinance, because we're always of the opinion that the state, every time, you know, when it goes through a code amendment, it generally changes it again a few months later as they realize some of the perhaps errors or tweaks that they need to make. So we ran with a temporary zoning ordinance until all those minor changes had been filtered out at the state level, and actually about a month ago the county council actually confirmed the final version of that ordinance. So we're running with that ordinance right now. On the types of subdivisions that it impacts, we've actually seen very little effect and impact at all, actually.
Yeah,
so it's not running badly in any way, shape, or form.
Does the new ordinance give county council retain the right, I guess, to call up a subdivision approval?
Not in that particular case. That ordinance actually requires the creation. If something there are certain appeals that have to go to certain appeal boards. In our county, our appeal board is the county council. So if a subdivision approval or non-approval is appealed, then the appeal authority is the county council. It's not something that the county council can reach down into the approval and change. But for the type of approval that was under consideration, we don't imagine that happening a lot. The more complex subdivision ordinances, those that would involve a rezone, for example, those are still, the rezone itself is the purview of the county council. That remains the case. So it's a very specific subset of a type of process that we go through that has been created by the state.
So any plans for the council then to appoint an appeals board like Park City Municipal has done?
We're actually looking at something perhaps even more. We're actually facing a set of appeals. Usually it's a little lower level, very individual projects actually. The council, in some extraordinary hiccup this year, maybe it's a full moon, maybe it's the announcement of the Olympics, I don't know, but the council have been looking probably at five separate appeals in the last 5 months. They take an extraordinary amount of time, and some of them are perhaps more worthy of appeal than others, but there's a legal process, public process, it's the right of every appellant to go through. We've actually, on the staff side and with the legal department side, we've actually looked to, you know, is there a possibility of appointing something like an appeals board, an appeal authority, an administrative law judge who looks quite specifically at some of these very narrow land use decisions. Now, obviously, that's a county council policy decision to make, and we're just in that conversation right now.
All right. Any word on the West Hills application? Again, we're talking about property that kind of the Garf Ranch into the Camas Valley there.
I don't want to be trite. I don't want to say that your guess is as good as mine. It's probably more accurate to say that the last news you heard is probably the last news I heard. I hear rumors. I hear that they keep going backwards and forwards with the state. Essentially, an incorporation or even an annexation process is actually outside the county authority until it actually becomes a real proposition, at which point we get to raise an objection with the state or point out our concerns or go wholeheartedly full-throated support for a project. But it's something that we are not involved with on a daily basis. So the last the last iteration that was published in the Park Record or published by the KPCW is exactly what I've been aware of, too.
Okay. Finally, I wanted to ask you about where are we with the dark sky code changes. This requires all outdoor light bulbs in Park City and unincorporated Summit County to be at 3,000 degrees Kelvin or less.
Sounds very technical, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. This comes from an ordinance that was passed, I think, in the Basin side about 7 years ago. All new buildings have been required to meet all dark sky lighting ordinances since then. All new building permits have been required to provide the hooded lighting, dark sky lighting. You see it in Park City. Park City Old Town, when I was designing in Old Town, had some very specific rules and regulations about light bulbs on the outside of the house, whether you could see them or not. The county adopted similar rules about 7 years ago. We're very aware of the fact that there are existing buildings, many of them. People are quite rightly and justifiably proud of their houses, and in some cases, they want to illuminate them so all their neighbors can see them. That's obviously having effect on those of us who dream of looking up at the stars in the clear mountain sky. So we passed an ordinance that said no light pollution, no reflectivity, nothing should leave your sight. In the intervening 7 years, the idea was that all existing property would bring their exterior lighting into compliance with that same code. That deadline is fast approaching. We are very aware that we have two code enforcement officers who are tasked with applying the code for 1,800 square miles of Summit County and shorty buying them all pellet guns and having them drive around Summit County and shoot light bulbs out. What are we going to do? So what we're actually going to do is take the education approach first. We will be releasing flyers in the mail. We will be publishing through our communications department website updates, flyers, interest, public notices that says this is how you can come into compliance if you're not. If you want advice on compliance, planning, code enforcement, we're more than happy to talk to anybody or visit with anybody to describe whether you are in compliance or not and how that can be achieved. Our objective is compliance with the code, not punitive enforcement. So we see it in the first stage exercise as an education, a reminder, and let's look at the benefits of what this will do for everyone.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, at 3,000 degrees Kelvin or less, I mean, is it like pornography? You'll know it if you see it?
Let's say yes. We shine a bit of a brighter light on it than hopefully the dark side of pornography. That number in particular is one of many technical requirements that come through this code. 3,000 degree Kelvin or less is what you would call a color temperature. A bright white light, in physics terms, is a blue light, and it's a 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 Kelvin light bulb. The dull yellow lights and the red lights are the much lower temperature, the 1 and the 2,000 degrees Kelvin, the warmer lights, the lower lights. LEDs tend to be brighter naturally. They can be many colors. If you're looking at bright blue lights with a high reflectivity, it's really the intensity of the light rather than the color temperature that's going to cause the glare. But people, the human eye, actually registers a higher color temperature, that 3,500, 4,000, and 5,000 degrees Kelvin, the human eye will sense that with a much more ability to create glare and discomfort in the eye. That's going to be distracting from the night sky, and that's the whole objective behind it. We can help people, we can show examples, we can explain how it works, and I'm very happy to do so.
Okay, Peter, appreciate your time. Talk to you next month.
Thank you, Leslie. Bye now.
The Odyssey Dance Theater returning to the Egyptian Theater with its ghoulish production of Thriller. And on the phone with details, I have the founder and artistic of Odyssey Dance Theater, Daryl Yeager. Good morning, Daryl.
Good morning.
So the show opens tonight. It'll run through Sunday, October 13th, 12 performances in all. Four of those are weekend matinees. The show is always a sellout. Randy Barton telling me that ticket sales are going well. And you did this for many years and then took a break and then you're back. Is it freshened up? I mean, tell us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, my wife and I wanted to serve a mission, and so we did that. We went to Martin's Cove up in Wyoming and had a great experience there. But in the process, we decided, you know, we weren't quite done yet. I mean, we kind of left the door open to bring the company back. And luckily, we didn't sell all of the thriller costumes that we had. And so we decided to bring the company back and thought we had left a big hole in the dance community here in Utah. And by not having the company around, and people really told me a lot that they missed Thriller. And so we thought, let's do it. Let's bring it back.
So are you telling me that the Odyssey Dance Theater is basically dissolved except for this production?
No, it was, we just put it on a little rest, you know, for a while. And while we were on our mission, and then now we're bringing it back.
Okay. So for somebody who has not seen it, how would you describe it?
Well, Thriller is kind of like a series of vignettes of all your favorite Halloween characters kind of put together in a dance form. I mean, it starts off, the show starts off with Thriller, which is, you know, Michael Jackson many years ago somehow decided that zombies love to dance. And so we kind of went with that. And from there, we have Frankenstein dancing with the Bride of Frankenstein. We have Dim Bones tap dancing skeletons. We have The Curse of the Mummy. We have Jason Jam, which we have three Jasons, and it's a really funny piece of three Jasons. One of the Jasons didn't quite graduate from Jason school, but they danced with ice picks, machetes, and eventually chainsaws. We have Salem's Mass, we have Lost Boys. I mean, there's just all these great, great pieces that gives you a real smattering of Halloween fun.
Yeah. Given it's a bit spooky, is there a recommended age limit on this?
Yeah, we usually say 8 and above. I mean, there are some scary elements in the show. But generally speaking, the thing that people really, I think, respond to is that there's a lot of humor. I mean, there's some very funny things in the show. And I think it's something that people really, really enjoy because they get to come and laugh, you know, and have a good time. And there's some really sick Halloween humor in it and, you know, things that that people really, really enjoy. And I think that's one of the things that's made it so popular over the years.
Yeah. How many performers do you have in it?
We have about 26 dancers, and then we also have like 11 little kids that are Chuckies. They do a piece called Chucky-Rama. And then we have around 15 zombies that kind of roam the halls in the theater before the show and during intermission and after the show. And we have some flyers, about 6 flyers who do some acrobatic acts, you know, flying in the air. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, this is that's a big production.
Yes, it is. It's a big show, but we somehow were able to fit it into that Egyptian theater, which is kind of small, but we love the intimacy of the theater. It's really one of the unique places we love to do the show because it provides a very unique audience participation thing.
Yeah. Now, will you be bringing the show to other theaters? Because I know you have done in the past down at Kingsbury.
Yes, we've always been. We've already done Ogden and Logan. We'll be here at Park City for 2 weeks, and then we're going to the Grand Theater in Salt Lake City, as opposed to Kingsbury Hall. Kingsbury Hall kind of kicked us out because they were planning on doing a presidential debate. And so we had to find another place to go. Who knows if that's going to happen, right? But the Grand Theater, which is at Salt Lake Community College on around 15th and State Street, beautiful theater. Big secret there is there's lots of parking, which Kingsbury Hall doesn't have. And so, but we're excited to go there. Great little theater. And then we'll be there for 2 weeks, and then we're going down to Tuacon, down in St. George.
Okay, yeah, so the Egyptian is kind of your smallest stop. Great.
It is. We go from the smallest theater to the largest at Tuacon.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit more about Odyssey Dance Theater. When did you found it?
We started in 1994, believe it or not, about 30 years ago. So, it's just been a very exciting thing to see grow from, you know, just a group of dancers. We got together and said, well, let's do a show. You know, I thought there was a big hole in the, you have Ballet West and you have Ryrie Woodbury and RDT, I thought there was a big place right in the middle where we could do kind of we call ourselves a jazz ballet company. And so, you know, we do all types of dance, ballet, jazz, tap, hip hop, ballroom, contemporary. You'll see all those styles within the shows that we do.
All right. And are you doing other shows besides Thriller throughout the year?
Yes, we're planning on doing our Christmas show in December, the 18th through the 23rd. And it's called the Christmas Spectacular Spectacular, because it's going to be kind of like Thriller, but for Christmas. So you're going to see, you know, pieces from It's a Wonderful Life, The Nutcracker, The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, The Christmas Story, Christmas Carol. You'll see all these different vignettes from all these different things. So it'll be kind of like your one-stop shop to come to see. Instead of going to all these different performances all over, you know, you can come here and get your Christmas fix in one fell swoop.
All right. And is that going to be here locally, or is that going to stay in?
That'll be at the Grand Theater. Mm-hmm. And then in the spring, we'll do our spring repertory season, which we call Shut Up and Dance. And that's where we really do a whole bunch of world premiere productions, new pieces. It's more of a repertory type season, and we're excited to bring that back. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, is it enough then to keep dancers busy, or is it?
Yeah. I mean, the dancers are all on salary, you know, we keep them pretty busy.
Okay. All right. Anything else you want to tell us about the show?
You know, get your tickets early. Get them right away. Like Randy said, you know, it's only 300 seats here, and we always sell out. So I would get them right away if you have a desire to come see an amazing show.
It really is. Okay. Thanks so much for telling us about it, Daryl.
You bet. Well, thanks for having me.
It's Daryl Yeager, again, the founder and artistic director of the Odyssey Dance Theater. Again, the production of Thriller opening tonight and will run through Sunday, October 13th at the Historic Egyptian Theater on Park City's Main Street. Well, crashes on US 40 in Wasatch County are a perennial problem. KPCW's Grace Dorfler now has more about how leaders would like to make the road safer.
County Manager Dustin Graybaugh says US 40 north of Heber is an especially dangerous section of the highway.
Pretty much every summer we have very serious accidents, often fatalities, in this stretch of North Highway 40. I think it's been a priority for UDOT for some time.
According to data from the Utah Department of Public Safety, there have been dozens of collisions on US 40 so far in 2024. Three of those were fatal crashes. The Wasatch County Council will discuss ways to improve road safety at its meeting Wednesday. Council members will share their feedback with the Utah Department of Transportation. Graybaugh says medians are one likely solution. He says adding a center divider will help reduce the number of risky left turns onto the highway.
When the road is very busy, it can be tempting to try and take a left turn, but it maybe isn't the safest alternative. And what this would do is force people to right turns and then take U-turns, which is admittedly inconvenient, but it's just the kind of the policy question of how do you weigh the convenience against those health and safety concerns.
He says tentative plans would have gaps in the median for possible future intersections, such as at the entrance to Utah Valley University's Wasatch campus. The medians would run along US 40 from River Road to 900 North. Wednesday's county council meeting begins at 4 p.m. Council members will also discuss priorities for the new transit tax, including funding paratransit for Wasatch County riders. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The International Olympic Committee president tried to ease worries that Utah could lose the 2034 Olympics due to an international dispute over a doping investigation. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on that.
IOC President Thomas Bach visited Utah last week to tour the state's Olympic facilities. During his visit, he sought to ease concerns that Salt Lake City could lose the 2034 Games if organizers don't support efforts to resolve conflict between anti-doping authorities. Those concerns were prompted in July when the IOC awarded Salt Lake City the 2034 Games. Just before Utah was awarded the Olympics, the host contract was amended to include a termination clause requiring the U.S. to comply with the World Anti-Doping Agency's authority. Bach called the amendment to the host contract a, quote, act of honesty Saturday.
It was just reflecting the rules. It was just saying this is why it was in a great agreement that the rules are like this, so that the IOC could be forced by a ruling of WADA to take measures or sanctions. And we are very confident that this does not need to happen. And we are not directly involved in this, nor is the organizing committee.
The contract change relates to a doping scandal involving Chinese Olympic swimmers who tested positive for a powerful banned substance before the 2021 Tokyo Games. WADA accepted China's explanation that the athletes were accidentally exposed to the drug, and several of the athletes went on to win medals. The United States has been extremely critical of WADA for its lack of action. There are ongoing talks to resolve the issue between WADA and the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. Bach said the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee is facilitating the discussions.
We are very confident that a good solution will be found.
Bach said this confidence is why the IOC chose to allocate the 2034 Games to Salt Lake City. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
In the studio now with a final update of this year's summer growing season, I have the Executive Director of Summit Community Gardens and Eats, Helen Adel. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Great to be here.
Yeah, so what's your assessment of this year's growing season? I know I got some potatoes and onions to go get.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad to hear you're still finding things to harvest. I would say it was an incredible season. It was very unpredictable. You know, we had frosts in June, in July, in August, in September. It's sort of hard to tell when the last frost was and when the first frost was. That said, we also had a really incredible amount of food grown by plot runners and by our staff in the center of the garden. So, you know, there's still in a beautiful abundance growing. The cooler temps, you know, at night right now mean that the end of the season is definitely approaching. But we've surpassed last year's, the amount of food that we grew last year for the food pharmacy. We're at 1,400 pounds. There are still potatoes in the ground. There are still tomatoes ripening. You know, we're covering those at night very carefully, and they are looking gorgeous. So there's still tons of food coming in. So we're really, really thrilled to have that much food.
Yeah. What was the total last year?
Last year, we were at 1,300 pounds of food that were delivered as part of the food pharmacy to folks experiencing food insecurity and chronic disease at the People's Health Clinic. You know, that's a partnership that we have with them and also with the Christian Center. This year, we're already at 1,400 pounds. So, you know, really looking to, you know, we're going to be increasing that significantly. And part of that is, you know, our staff grows most of the food, but we have some wonderful plot runners. Annie, Michelle, Bill, Arnold, Arlene, and Roy, who are growing specifically for the food pharmacy in an extra plot. And then we also have just lots of plot runners who just bring food on a Wednesday when they know we're harvesting for the food pharmacy. So, you know, major thanks to everyone who has contributed to the bounty that we're able to provide to community members this season.
Okay, and you didn't think that was going to happen. I remember early on you were thinking, oh, we're not going to hit that.
So, you know, we definitely wondered. I mean, I think that frost in July had us a little, you know, had us wondering what was going to happen. But I do think that it requires that growing, you know, high altitude growing requires a lot of kind of attention and diligence, right? So like checking the temperatures, when is it going to be freezing? When do I need to cover things? All of that. And, you know, we are definitely getting towards the end. I'll just say that we do have our garden cleanup is this Saturday the 5th from 11 to 2. It's a good time to get in and, you know, start cleaning things out. That said, the garden does not close until we can't open the door because of the snow. So, you know, people are welcome to come in. But it really is an amazing community to grow with. There's just a lot of friends, a lot of learning opportunities. Just it's a great community. And, you know, that the garden cleanup day will be a lot of fun. And, you know, Leslie, I do want to throw out a garden tip for whether you're a plot runner with us or whether you're somebody who loves to grow at home. It's a great time to get your garlic. Getting garlic in the ground. Garlic is a bulb, right? So just like a lot of folks are planting flower bulbs, this is a great time to plant garlic. In a few weeks, when it's just, you know, the daytime temperatures are a little colder as well. You're just going to plant that garlic. You can plant a cloves of garlic, cover it with straw or some other kind of mulch, and you will be so happy to be pulling that up in the summer.
So you can just this garden, I mean, that's just the stuff you buy in the store,
you know,
or do you need something else?
There are some special, like there are definitely better varieties. We will be selling some at the garden, at the, you know, at our garden cleanup day, along with, I got to say,
gorgeous honey that we harvested from the garden, thanks to Root Revival. We've got beautiful, we had about 8 or 9 gallons that we harvested this year. It's all in beautiful little jars. So anyway, you can buy garlic from us, honey from us, but also places like Mill Creek Nursery down in Salt Lake have really great growing varieties. And you can get your straw to cover it up from PC Nursery, PC Gardens, right on 224 across from the garden. So definitely, just encourage people to think it's not too late to plant something for next season.
Okay, and this is the time where you ask plot renters to renew?
That's right, yes. So that will be going out this week. So for any plot renters who want to renew, the time is now. And then we're going to be opening up. We already have new plot renters for 2025. We've got a bunch of people on that list already. Please join us, grow in community with us. You learn a lot about just how to have a successful high altitude growing season. We're going to have some new ways the garden can help support plot runners next season as well, which I'll be excited to talk to you about next, when we get started next year. I guess, Leslie, I would love to give a special shout out to the garden team. This is actually the last day that our seasonal folks will be with us, which is part of why Melissa Soltes, our garden director, isn't here. They really wanted to work together one last day. But, Gus Klein really did some incredible work with volunteers as well as, growing. And Amy Tagmeyer, second year in a row that she's been with us, thanks to both of them for helping the garden flourish. They'll be up at PC Mountain this season, so you can wave to them up there. And also just have to give a shout out to Melissa, our garden director, who's just been, over the last 2 years, an incredible resource, making that garden a beautiful and really abundant place.
Okay, and you have finished with the La Milpa season?
Yeah, so the final program for La Milpa, La Cosecha, the harvest, was last week. We had 3 workshops, overall about 160 people in attendance, and really learning about cultural knowledge from the indigenous community in Mesoamerica, really highlighting identity, how growing is connected to identity. There were some incredible stories from people who were participating about why it was important for them to be there, bring their children, that this is a long history of being connected to growing food. And it's a really beautiful program. We're really excited that partnership with Artes de Mexico in Utah will continue next year. We've been doing some deep work with Holy Cross Ministries as well around La Milpa programming.
So. Okay. And what about your education programs? Are those wrapping up then? I mean, it's kind of the after school in the garden?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So after school in the garden is actually still continuing. And folks, there's a great drop-in program. You can go to our website, just, register your child Monday, Thursday, Friday. That runs through October. And that will be kind of our final program in the garden, our educational program in the garden. Of course, we started teaching up in the schools in late August. So this month we've been piloting a wonderful new recipe, an apple granola parfait in all the elementary schools with Curious Cooks. We're doing Eat the Rainbow, our pre-K program with PC Tots and Holy Cross Ministries, doing fruit skewers with them and really, highlighting the different colors of all the fruits there. Our greenhouse programs are operating in Parleys and Park City Day School, and lots of other in-school and after-school programs. If folks are interested in having, our programs in your child's school, you can reach out to me at Helen at Summit Community Gardens. I'd love to hear more and partner.
Okay, and in terms of volunteers, you're still looking for some?
Yeah, I mean, our food security initiatives go year-round. So for the food pharmacy, we are always looking for people to deliver the food that we raise. We have some great, late-season crops that are being stored. But also our partners at the Christian Center will kick in with some grants to purchase food during the winter months when we're not growing. We need folks to deliver that food, to pick it up at the Christian Center, drop it off to, there are roots in Wasatch County and Summit County. You can go onto the website at Christian Center. We also have a link to it in our website. And also our Fruit to Schools program, where we deliver fruit to all of the elementary schools and middle schools and Holy Cross Ministries in Park City every week for kids who are free and reduced lunch eligible and, just need a snack, need something else during the day besides that free breakfast and lunch to help keep them going. And it's another serving of fruits and vegetables. So.
Okay. Let's see. You also had a fundraising event back last month. How did that go?
Oh, my goodness. Farm to Fork up at the Pendry, our presenting sponsor up at the Pendry, Roof Deck, was incredible. It's the biggest fundraiser of our year for a lot of nonprofits, small nonprofits, large nonprofits. It's an important way to kind of sustain the organization throughout the year. We more than doubled our goal. It was an incredible night. Beautiful setting on the Pendry Roof Deck. I don't know if you've spent much time up there, Leslie, but it is really, there is a stunning view, great vibes. It's just really great energy, amazing food at the Pendry, really fun cocktails, great vibes. There were, just people in the room who really believed in our mission. We had one of the founders of Eats, one of the founders of Summit Community Gardens, lots of folks who've been with us for a long time, as well as lots of new friends who were, who were attracted by kind of the merger, what that means in terms of impact, our passion, our dedication, what we're doing. It was just a great night. And I do want to just give, another shout out to our presenting sponsor, Pendry Park City. That team under Chris Lawing, just incredible service, top to bottom. And I also would love to give a shout out to our other sponsors, PC Yoga Collective, feeding, body and heart and soul, Susan O'Dell and Mountaintown Olive Oil, and Rebecca's Kitchen. And then, of course, the entire staff of the Pendry and our staff and our great development committee. So it was a beautiful night. We really had a wonderful time.
Great. So how much did you raise?
We raised well over what we had planned. We thought we were going to raise $20,000, and we well over doubled that. So it was exciting. And it's just, there's really important ways to support nonprofits all year long. Our dinners in the garden, we just had our final dinner in the garden. Wanted to give a shout out to the restaurant Raptex and Chamber Sustainable Tourism for helping to support that program. And our restaurant partners were really incredible. Most recently, Firewood on Main, just an exquisite 5-course menu. Also, Alpine Distilling, our first program, Nosh, Wasatch Provisions, SD Pizzeria, and Red Banjo Pizza. Just great partners for us.
Great. And so do you do anything in the winter? Or you say that basically the snow kind of closes the garden.
Yeah, in the garden, we don't do as much in the garden, but we will be, there is so many other ways to get involved. There's great info about gardening up on the website. We will be starting our, education programs about gardening in March. You can volunteer, you can sign up for our newsletter, you can become a member. So there's still lots of ways to get involved. And of course, our education programs, we see 1,800 kids in the school, unique children in the school every year. So still lots going on at Summit Community Gardens and Eats.
Okay, we'll see you next year.
Thank you so much, Leslie.
Helen Nadel, again, is the Executive Director of Summit Community Gardens and Eats. Well, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and one federal survey found 1 in 3 women and 1 in 10 men will experience domestic violence sometime in their life. Park City's Peace House hosting their annual event to celebrate survivors and to create change in our community. The survey results come from the National Institute of Health, and the executive director of Peace House, Kendra Wyckoff, says while the local rates are likely similar, domestic violence often goes unreported.
It's very difficult sometimes to pinpoint exactly what is happening behind the closed doors in our homes. But what we do know is that, in Park City, generally the police department sees anywhere between about 80 and 100 cases a year of domestic violence or family fights. Summit County, historically, we've seen their numbers around 200 cases. And then at Peace House, we're serving on average now about 500 people year to year. And those are just the folks that are reaching out for help.
Domestic Violence Awareness Month, she says, was started in the late 1980s to raise awareness and encourage people to get involved to prevent family violence by learning to identify signs of abuse and to get the tools to help those who may need it. On Saturday, Peace House Outreach Manager Erin Metal says they're hosting its annual Be the Light event in Heber's Main Street Park from 3 to 5 p.m.
We plan to have a walk around the park in Heber. We have an excellent lineup of speakers, the mayor of Heber, Heidi Franco, as well as Celine Olson, who is a local of Park City. And she will be telling her story as a survivor, but also her resiliency and her efforts in creating change in our community. So we have a great lineup of live music, and then we also have food trucks that are available. And then we'll have some community partners out there sharing the resources.
PSAS asks for participants to register for the event. They're also looking for volunteers to help set up and tear down. You can find the link to register or to volunteer online at kpcw.org.